lipstick on my collar,
and wrinkles in my dress. Two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say goodnight.
Here we are, crazy in the head. Gee, your eyes are gorgeous.
Yeah.
Even when they're red. Two sleepy people who know very well
they're too much in love to break the spell.
Do you remember the nights we used to cuddle in the car?
Uh-huh.
Watching every last fading star.
And remember the doctor said your health was under par.
And you, my little snooks, were ruining your looks.
Well, here we are, keeping up the pace,
letting each tomorrow slap us in the face.
Two sleepy people by dawn's early light, and too much in love to say goodnight.
Bob Hope and Shirley Ross from the movie Thanks for the Memory. It's a minute to four. This is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. We'll join National Public Radio at 5 tonight for All Things Considered, and that will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. With me now on Fresh Air is Roosevelt Grier, who was a football star in the 1950s and 60s when he played with the New York Giants, then the Los Angeles Rams, where his defensive line was known as the Fearsome Foursome. At 6'5", he's a big man who occasionally had to crash diet to weigh in at 280 pounds. His imposing presence was also an asset when he worked as an unofficial bodyguard for Robert Kennedy. And you may remember that when Kennedy was assassinated, Grier pinned down Sirhan Sirhan until the police arrived. Since retiring from the NFL, Grier has acted on TV and in films, sung professionally, and worked on behalf of various political candidates. A few years ago, he was born again, and he now runs a ministry for inner-city youth called Are You Committed? He spent his childhood on his parents' farm in Cuthbert, Georgia, where they raised peanuts, corn, and watermelons. The family moved to New Jersey when he was in high school. Grier tells the story of his life in his new book, The Gentle Giant, Rosie, published by Honor Books. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I love the name of the show, Fresh Air. That's good.
Oh, I'm glad you like it. A lot of athletes who play in the major leagues have come from small towns or small farms that are not used to fame and publicity, and they're also not used to money, and they end up being emotionally unprepared for the status and being, you know, being in the limelight and for the money that comes along with pro sports. Now, I was wondering if you felt you were in that position when you first joined the NFL.
We didn't make that kind of money. Of course, it was good. I was raised up. When I was in grammar school, my principal called me in the office and said to me that I could be a positive influence or a negative influence. And I made my mind up a long time ago to be a positive influence. So I would not have been able to get off track like some of the guys are today. Of course, today they're making so much money and they're just youngsters. They're not grown-up men. These guys are coming from home. They've never done anything else but go to college and high school, and they come out and they're going into the pros. They're free. They have all this money, and everyone is reaching for them, and they get off track because they thought when they got all those things they were going to be secure, and they found out that they weren't. And so they got involved in so many things that pulled them down.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. You grew up on a farm in Georgia. You were one of 13 kids, was it?
Yeah.
How old were you when you were expected to go to work on the farm?
I was 5 when I started working. You know, because usually when you lived in the South, most people worked on as sharecroppers. That means that the guy you work for paid for all the seed that you need. You went out and you planted, and then you live by credit all year long. And at the end of the year, some of these guys made $5 and all that, you know. But we were fortunate enough to have our own farm because there was some kind of government grant that gave people who had a certain an ability to rent the farmland from the government, and they farmed the land. They didn't need a sharecrop. So I lived like that. But it was required that all the family members participate in the farm work, and that was shaking peanuts, picking cotton, going to the cane mill. But everyone had to do their part there.
Your father, when you were 11 or something, went up north to see, to scout out the north for the family, and ended up choosing a place in New Jersey where you had relatives.
Yeah.
What made your parents want to come north?
Well, there, you know, my we used to get visitors from our relatives from up north, you know, up north, you know, you hear what I'm saying? It was like up north was a place where they had these money trees. And everyone lived under a money tree, and the money just fell down on them, and they all were successful, you know. And they all wore nice clothes, and they didn't have to worry about the mules and the horses and the corn and all that stuff. And my aunt had a house in New Jersey, and she kept writing my dad, why don't you come on up north and bring that family out from down there, you know. And finally, one year, my dad, you know, been struggling on a farm for so many years. We never had the great land. And so he decided that he was going to go up north, and he took off early and went up to find work and to, you know, make sure that we had furniture in the house and all that. And we had to stay home while he went, and we had to sell off all the farm, you know, furniture and the horses and the cows and the hogs and the pigs and the cats and the dogs, you know. And we had to get all that stuff taken care of. And then finally my dad called and said, okay, it's time for us all to go road, as a matter of fact, and sent tickets, and we all took off, went on the Chitlin' Circuit. I mean, on the Chicken Bone Express, you know, where all the people from the South were moving up north, and they cooked all the chicken, and they went up there. So it was just great for me to leave.
What was your first impressions of New Jersey? There was a lot you were probably unprepared for.
Oh, I couldn't tell you how unprepared I was, because here we come to this town, and you don't have you don't have the cows to feed, you don't have the farm, you can't go out and get stuff, you got to go and buy everything, you know. And also now I had the ability to go to school all the time. It was required that every kid go to school until he was 16, and I was only 11. I had 5 years that I was required to go to school. I love that, but I spoke so differently than the other kids, and they all laughed at me for a while, you know. And I didn't understand that, you know, because, you know, we were always taught not to laugh and make fun of people, and yet these kids were making fun of me, but I didn't care, you know. I was going to school.
Were you considered a hillbilly, having come from the South?
A country bumpkin.
And that was bad?
No, it wasn't. It might have been bad to them, but see, I didn't understand all that stuff, so I look at them like they're weird, you know. I said, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. I felt comfortable.
You did really well in sports when you were in high school, and you probably had a choice of several colleges you could have gone to on athletic scholarships. You chose Penn State. Why did you want to go there?
Well, actually, I had about 28 offers to go to school, and one school I went and visited Virginia State, and I had never seen a blue-eyed black woman in my life. I mean, I looked at that girl, I thought, well, it's a blue-eyed black lady, and it just blew me away, and I thought about Virginia State. Then I thought, why would I go to Virginia State? And I went back home, and I went to Seton Hall, visit Seton Hall, and there was a couple other schools I went and visited. And then I got a call one day. I came home from work, and my dad said, well, there's a man came in from a place called Penn State, and he wants you to come up and visit that school. I said, well, Papa, I don't have time to go up there. He said, well, he wants you to come up there. He said, just come on up and visit the school and look them over, and they'd like to offer you a scholarship. I said, well, okay. So one weekend I took off and went to Penn State. And there was something very different about this school. There was the kids up there. They weren't hyping me about coming to school. They was telling me about the academics. They was telling me what a great school it was be to go to, and Tony Hyatt rated academically, and just basically gave me a great run through about what the school was like. And so I made my mind up to go to Penn State, and I never regretted it.
It was a pretty white school then, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness, was it white? Yes. They had all these thousands of kids up there, maybe a few hundred blacks. But that to me, I never looked at any person, black or white, but they was better than I. I always looked at every person as the same. You see, I always felt that I'm as good as anyone, and I'm no better than anyone else. So I never had an inferiority complex there. I wasn't used to white people, but I was at least comfortable.
One of the obstacles you came across was in the postseason games. There ended up being a quota for blacks, for people who could play.
Well, that was basically more in the pros than in the college. In college, there were no quotas as I know of, but at the end of my college career, when I had a chance to go to some of the bowl games, when the coach came to me and he told me that, he said, I want to tell you that I know it's nothing I can do about this, but you're not going to be able to play in some of the postseason game because of they're only going to have so many blacks that's going to be invited to some of these postseason games, and you're not one. And I was very hurt by that. I mean, it really devastated me. But I was very fortunate that I was picked to play in the All-Star game, which is probably the biggest postseason game there is, to play against the National Football League champion. And so I went in Chicago and played in the All-Star game, and we beat the Cleveland Browns. And so that was a really wonderful thing. And I kind of like thought, ha.
Roosevelt Grier is my guest. He's written an autobiography titled Rosie the Gentle Giant. When you were recruited by the NFL, you were drafted in the third round by the Rams, and then you were immediately traded to the Giants, which is, I think, the team you wanted to play for.
Yes,
in the first place. Did you do anything to try to get chosen by the team of your choice? What power did you have then when you were being drafted?
None. See, what was happening with me? I started getting all these letters. I mean, I wasn't even considering playing pro football. I started getting all these letters from these teams, and I wrote them all back. I said, I don't want to play for you. I mean, dumb, talking about dumb. I wrote them all back, said, I don't want to play for you. I want to play only for the New York Giants. And I was given later on when I was drafted by the Rams, and immediately I was traded to the New York Giants as part of a trade that they made with the Rams to get, I think, Robustelli or Del Schaffner. Andy Robustelli and Del Schaffner, who later became all Hall of Famers for the New York Giants.
I guess the recruiters must have thought you were pretty naive writing them back saying, oh, no, I'm only going to play with the Giants or nobody. So, but they kept recruiting you anyways.
Yes. It was really, I mean, I didn't have no idea about pro football. I never forget when I went to negotiate my contract. I mean, it was really a riot. I finally went on to the Giants office. I said, well, I mean, you're going to sign me or what? You know, we weren't allowed to have representatives. Of course, I probably wouldn't have had any anyway. But I went over there and I signed my first contract. I got a bonus of $500. I mean, listen.
What were you getting paid that first year?
First year I made $7,000.
How did that compare with the going rates for?
These guys tip in a week probably what I was making in here. These guys today, yeah.
No, but when you were first drafted, was that a typical?
No, I don't think. I had another kid that came in with me. He made $5,500. He was a fullback, Mel Triplett. And I think what happened is that, see, during those period of time, they talked to ball players not to tell the other ball player how much he was making. I don't know what Andrew Robustelli was making. I don't know what Dick Mojalesco was making, or Cat Cavage, or Sam Huff. We never knew what those guys were making. And today, when I find out some of the salaries, I'm amazed that we were so dumb.
What would you have done differently if you could do it? If you could do that again, if you could negotiate your contract again?
Oh, if I could do it differently, I'd probably be open to all the teams. And then I would have an idea on what the other ball players are making in the league, so I would at least come in comparable to what they're making today. And see, now what's happening today is that most of these agents who negotiate the contract for the ball players, they know what range the top ball players are making, so they go for those areas of finance for those ball players today. So the ball player himself might not know what the other ball players are making, but comparatively, the agents do. They know what they're making. In fact, they get access to some of the rosters, and they know exactly what the ball players are making. So they try to get their particular ball player the same kind of salary as the top ball player.
Was there anything like an initiation process when you joined the Giants?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, what happened was that the rookies, they had a rookie night. And we were so, I mean, we had a rookie night that was so bad that the owner got really mad. I mean, some of the guys were really filthy. And, of course, I didn't do any of that stuff. I didn't like that. But the guys that was in the rookie group, they did some incredible things, and I couldn't believe it. But
anything that you can describe?
No.
No? That bad, huh?
No. But that's, you know, always, it wasn't bad, though. I mean, they make you get up and sing your alma mater, and they make you say stuff, you know, that about your school, or make speech, or they call and do all kind of things to break you in, make you part. I mean, just kind of fun thing they did.
You wrote in your book that you were worried when you joined the Giants that the people, the white people there from the South on the team or in management might prove to be really racist. So
yes.
Did your fears prove to prove out? I mean, was that a problem?
No, as a matter of fact, Jim Lee Howell was from Arkansas. Charlie Conley was from Mississippi. Cairo from SMU. And there was all these guys from all over the place. And I thought that, you know, if I left the South, I began to encounter a little bit of racism. And when I went back to play in some of the Southern schools, I play in Texas, all these places. But, you know, the greatest thing I found that Charlie Conley and I became very good friends. We're good friends today. Jim Lee Howell was one coach that I really admire. Man was very, very fair. And so my anticipation of racism never really occurred as a part of the team. Now, it did happen when we traveled. Like, I remember once we played in Arkansas, that the black ball players had to stay in different hotels in 55. And so that was a new experience for me. I was never aware of that. And I thought when you got the pros, all those things, you were above that, but it wasn't. And it wasn't, I think, sometime in 56 that we had to play in Dallas, Texas, that the black ball players from Baltimore coach and the black ball players from the Giants say, well, we're not going to go to any of the affairs of just the ball game. And so we all decided not to go to the affairs. Of course, when we the coaches found out what we were doing, our coach came over and said, well, I know you all didn't want to do this. And so we said, no, we don't want to do this because we are not part of the team. We have to stay over here, and we can't. Why should we go there and let them gawk at us over there if we can't be a part of the team in the hotel? And so Mr. Wellington Merrill came. He said, well, I never knew you all felt like that, and I promise you that the New York Giants will never again stay in segregated places. And so he also informed us that if we didn't go and be a part of the that function, that a lot of the ball players that had potential to make a team were not going to get a chance, and that we had a responsibility to these guys to make sure that we didn't jeopardize their opportunities to make the ball club. So, of course, we capitulated and went, and we never ever again stayed in segregated hotels. The New York Giants never did, and the Baltimore coach never showed up.
It must have been a big decision to take a stand on that and refuse to participate.
It was frightening.
Yeah, because you hadn't been very political before.
No,
that
not
you
at
hadn't
all.
Been active in the civil rights movement.
Right. I hadn't. See, looking at all those things, those civil rights movement and all the NAACP and all those things, it was like looking into another world. It was so far away from me. Looking at the presidential election, I've faintly heard it. You know what I'm saying? It's like I wasn't tuning over there. I was tuned into athletics. I was tuned into to track and basketball and all those things, and I wasn't aware. I just wasn't. And that was a beginning of my to becoming aware and begin to speak up about my feelings about what was important for me to be a part of a team. So it was a little bit of growth for me.
My guest is Roosevelt Grier, who's just written a new autobiography. It's titled Rosie, the Gentle Giant. When you are about to get someone, tackle them, do you brace yourself in any way for the fall that's to come, or if you're about to get tackled, do you like tense up or try to relax to cushion the blow a little bit?
You try to go with the flow. I mean, one thing I learned as a defensive tackle is that never, if I didn't have to, don't meet that guy head on. Get him at an angle. And if you get him at an angle, you will not take the brunt of the collision. Now, there are times when you have to, but that's an awful hard shock to your body. And as a matter of fact, even today, I mean, some of those direct hits, boy, really agitate your body today. But what I learned was that try to get the guy on an angle, give him a good shot, but don't ever try to take the brunt of the hit. And backs learn, never meet these big dudes head on. Give them an angle. And when they get you, go down. Don't try to fight it. Because when you try to stay up on your feet, unless you have an ability to come out fast, you're going to get hurt. And what I learned as a defensive tackle, when I tried something new in the game, it usually wound up I got hurt. So I tried to stay within the realm that I had practiced all week, the things that I had learned. I tried to stay within that realm. And the only time I went for new stuff was when I was outside in practice.
Did you have a way of falling so that you wouldn't get hurt as much? Is there a way to fall?
Sure. Everyone practices. I mean, as an athlete, you practice. In practice, you practice falling, hitting the ground, rolling, getting up, hitting the ground, rolling, getting up. So it comes automatically. What you try not to do is try not to fall on points. You don't want to fall direct on your elbow. You don't want to fall directly on your hand. You want to fall where you're rolling on your shoulder, or you want to fall with your head tuck. If you're going over, you tuck. You always learn to tuck. If you're going back, you tuck and roll. So then you never get caught in where your arm is bent backwards or your leg is out of position where someone can get solid on it and break your leg. So you learn all those things. You learn that if a guy's going for your legs, as opposed to you breaking, you go up and let him take you over, and you flip over, and next thing you're up and gone again. So you learn all those things in practice. And you learn all those things, not just in the pros. You start that in high school. You start that in grammar school. You learn how to roll. You learn how to tuck and roll. You learn how to take the hit and get up.
Are there some people who do their tackling in a more sadistic way than others? I mean, do some people like tackle with some regard for whether it's going to hurt the person they're tackling or not, and other people try to just really kill them?
Sure, there are guys who I watch guys today, they go out there and they got these images, and they go out there, they try to kill people. Well, I mean, Butkus was that kind of guy. I mean, he went out there to kill people, and I mean, you can play that way if you want to. What I found in my play was that I take a guy down as hard as I could, but when the whistle blew, I quit. And I didn't go out to try to take a guy's head off. I went down to take him down, make him lose yardage, but I never went out there to try to deliberately tear a guy's head off. Because to me, as time went on, I remember saving Jim Brown, Ollie Madsen, Johnny Unitas. I saved all those guys when I could have really hurt them because they were out of position. They was trapped in a way that could break their legs or break their body up, and I held off. And later on, I had guys catch me in the same position where they could have maimed me, and they said, Rosie, and hit me high. Now, they took me out, but they didn't break my leg. So I was very thankful that I never, on the field, never got really seriously hurt. I got my back and my ankles and all that and my knees, but no guy deliberately went out to hurt me and take me out of the game.
Did you ever talk to each other during one of those pile-ups?
Oh, yeah.
What did you say?
I used to have the most fun. I used to always talk to Johnny Unitas. You know, Johnny Unitas, when his ball players got tired near the end of the game or fourth quarter, he said, ref, measure that. And I said, Johnny, you know you don't have no first down, man. He said, oh, Rosie, shut up. You know you need a rest, too, you know. And we used to, you know, I never forget standing back there, and you stand on the line, the quarterback coming out, and you say, hey, quarterback. Hey, Bart Starr, one of those quarterbacks, he said, you're not going to come this way, are you? Because I'm going to kill everything that come over this way, you know. And you'd be laughing, you know, and I remember playing a guy named Jim Parker. I remember one time playing Jim Parker, and I hit Jim Parker, and I beat him. And I was going for the quarterback, and he turned around and threw a crossbody block on my leg and almost broke my ankles. And I fell on the ground. I rolled. I said, Jim, that's really dirty, man. He said, Rosie, man. He said, I'm sorry, man. I didn't know that was you. I said, Jim, you dirty rat, man. You know it was me, you know. Other time, I rushed in the backfield, and I went past Johnny Unitas, man, almost took his head off. And Johnny said, where'd you come from? I said, I beat your man over there, you know. And so he said, Jim, why didn't you block him? I said, Jim, don't let him talk like that because he's white, man. It was all those kind of things. You just laughed and you have fun on the field. That was fun.
Could you ever say something like, I think my arm's hurt, or watch out for the arm or something? Like if you've fallen in an awful position.
Oh, you scream.
You could tell someone else is about to land on you and
yes.
They could really hurt you and you feel very vulnerable.
You scream, yeah. That was one time I had both legs trapped under me. And I was over back as far as I could go on my leg, and these guys was coming down on me, and I started screaming. And I couldn't fall. I couldn't open my legs up so I can get my body down. I was trapped over backwards, and my knees was cracking, and I started screaming, and they all came up. And I hurt both knees, but I wasn't bad. It could have been much, much worse.
I guess having never played football, it's hard for me to think of getting psyched up enough. So
I'm
going to
tackle you before it's over, so you're going to find out about all this.
But it's just hard for me to imagine daily preparing myself for that much physical punishment. What would you do to psych yourself up, knowing what you were in store for?
I don't think it's a matter of psyching yourself. You see, today when I watched the game, I thought, oh, man, I can't believe I played that game. You know, I mean, I see all these guys. I see all those pileups, and you hear all this socking. You see those guys diving into the pile, and they seem like they're trying to kill somebody. But yet, when you practice all week and you go out and you practice every day, it's a relief to play a game because, I mean, it's you play two or three downs and you're out and you rest and you then the other guys go and they play a few downs. It's not nearly as bad as it looked because you're used to it and you know that when guys fall in there, they know how to fall, they know how to protect themselves, and very rarely do you get a guy out of position. He know to keep his arms and his leg in close to him. If he put his legs in there, he don't stick one leg, they're both in there so that he can go down, or he's in a position where he can stretch out, he can give with the force of all the people. So it's not really that bad. Now, what really hurts is when you get the back is more likely to get, you know, when a guy's, you've seen guys pull a guy's helmet or get his hand in the face mask. Well, that's when you get a guy hurt really badly. Or when you see a lineman rush in and grab a quarterback and sling him to the ground, or hold him up and they pile into him. See, that's dangerous. I remember watching Joe Theismann when he got hurt. Those are rare things. A man get caught blindsided, and that's what you have to really watch. When you need to be alert out there on the field. You know, if I have a rush in the backfield and no one hit me, boy, you better believe a guy's going to go down low. Me, I'm going to go down low and I'm going to be looking for someone coming because I'm not supposed to go through clean. You know, and so those are things that as you develop your skills on the football field, you also learn how to protect yourself. You know, you see guys go over backwards. The first thing come up is his legs. And so when a guy come in charged in on him, he's going to kick him. He's not going to take the hit.
My guest is Roosevelt Greer. He's written a new autobiography titled Rosie. And this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. You say that there are more restrictive regulations on what defensive linemen can do now than there were when you were playing. What are some of the things that you could do when you were playing that would be illegal now?
Well, I developed a head slap. What meant that if I was going to rush you to your inside, I'd take a first one fast step with my right foot outside to your left shoulder. In time you lean that way to block me, I slap you with my inside left hand, slap you on your helmet. And I stun you with such a blow that you'll be stunned. And next thing you know, I'll be in the backfield on the quarterback. Well, Deacon Jones perfected that to such an extent that they outlawed the head slap altogether. That stopped. They used to do a lot of bumping and running, and they kind of you can only hit the guy once you go 5 yards, you can't hit him no more. There are so many things, like I should stick my hand in the guy's face and all those kinds of things. They outlawed a lot of things. You can't deliberately let a shoot a guy to the face with your elbow. There are a lot of things, but now they allow them to hold a little bit more. Defensive guys can hold more. I mean, offensive guys can hold the defense more than ever before. And so it's leading to more scoring. And I think right now perhaps the offense is ahead of the defense, but I think the defense is catching up fast.
What are some of the worst injuries you got when you were playing?
Well, the worst injury I got in high school. A guy fell on my back, and my sacroiliac went out. And dumb me, I'm so anxious to play, I let them send me to a doctor, and they gave me a shot of Novocaine in my back, which is the worst thing that anyone could ever do to a young kid. Don't ever, youngsters, allow someone to shoot Novocaine in your kid so he can continue to play. That's the dumbest thing. And I've had trouble with my back ever since.
You think you'd injured it more by playing?
Oh, sure, yeah. Absolutely. All my life I had trouble with my back.
I don't understand how you can play with a bad back.
Oh, because it doesn't hurt when the Novocaine is in there.
No. But I mean afterwards, all those years when it was still a chronic problem.
Oh, no. You tape it up and you get your leg, your back adjusted. You know, he learned to pop it in all the time.
Did you go to chiropractors?
Yeah.
Things like that?
On our team, we had him. A guy like that. And Chuck Medler was a guy who's very good at that. He could pop your back and you get heat treatment always and the pain go out. It wasn't constant, you know, it wasn't that chronicle, but I used to tape my back all the time to make sure. And then I learned how to, you know, when you lie down, you lie straight and you didn't get your leg all twisted out of position. You kind of make sure that we were lying properly so your back didn't go out. So, I mean, that was my whole lifetime. The other thing I got hurt was my knee, and second injury against Illinois, I hurt my knee for the first time. And in the pros, I got my knee hurt again, the other knee hurt. And when I retired, I retired with a broken Achilles tendon. So those were basically the injuries. I think one serious injury I got was after I got out in acting. I broke my quadricep ligaments. And so that was fooling around with Michelle Lee jumping on a trampoline. I mean, you could see a guy 290 pounds jumping on a trampoline, got too high, tried to stop, my leg snapped.
Did you get used to playing with pain? Could you just mentally block it out?
No. Ah! I'd be screaming. No. Now, what you learn to do is that you learn how to protect your pain. You learn, like, I remember, never forget one time my ligaments in my left arm was severed. Basically, it didn't break. Break would have been better. My arm didn't break, but the ligament was stretched out of, I mean, just really torn. And I had put on this big rubber pad on my arm, you know, and we came down to play the Philadelphia Eagles, you know, and I stuck my arm out there, you know, trying to do it. And this guy reached over and hit me on my arm, and I fell withering on the ground. I said, I'm going to kill you. And I couldn't play, but I learned one thing, cover both arms. So don't let them know which one. And I played for about 5 or 6 games with one arm.
Is that typical that someone would really try to take advantage of your vulnerability and hurt you like that?
Oh, sure. Uh-huh. I mean, I've played, and the coach said, well, I'm not saying go out and hurt the guy, but his left knee, he's hurt, you know.
Right.
So if you go in there, and it all depends on who you were, you'd take a little swack at his knee and make him jump back and pretend you're going to hit it, you know.
You mentioned that Novocaine before, and that one of the worst things you ever did was take the shot of Novocaine in your back when you were a student and were injured.
High school.
Yeah, and then you went back and play. But one of the things that is done in professional sports is the use of steroids and painkillers and drugs to take down swellings and things like that. Did players use a lot of that when you were playing? And do you think that those things are dangerous?
I didn't. I took they told me that there was pills that if I got hurt in the game, I took pills so that the swelling would keep down. But what we learned to do is ice our bodies, ice the injury down so that the swelling would stop and the bleeding would stop. And that's what we did. But I was not aware of the drugs, the dappers and all those things earlier. I remember once when a guy told me to try some dappers, I tried dapper, and I thought they said, well, in the fourth quarter, you're going to have all this energy. And it didn't happen to me until 12 o'clock at night. I had all that. And so I thought, boy, that's really dumb, and it made me sick, too. You know, I said, that's it. But later on, near the end of my career, I began to notice something strange happening. I never forget one time I went down to visit some ball players, and there was all these guys in this room. They were smoking marijuana. And I took off and left, and I went away, and I was shaking my hand. I said, I can't believe it. I don't believe these guys are doing it. You know, it showed me something that they were going someplace, and they shouldn't be going there. It was going to lead to a lot of problems. And so later on, you find that a lot of kids was coming into the pros who had been into drugs for a long time, and they all thought that they could handle it. And now they were in there, and the high that they used to get off of marijuana, they weren't getting it no more, so they had to go to the stronger stuff, which was cocaine and all that. And it's a tragedy, you know, that these guys allowing themselves to be destroyed, because that's exactly what's happening. And it's unfortunate that the heroes of our youngsters today are falling victims to drugs, and that's what they are. They are victims.
Do you support urine tests?
I support mandatory drug testing. I sure do.
You don't think it's an invasion of privacy?
This is against the law. It's a violation of the law. If a man was out drunk driving, they'd take a breathalyzer. And so what's wrong with cleaning up sports and making it wonderful for people to trust in it again? Because if they don't do it, if I was a fan, I'd stop going to the game. I said, if you don't want to clean the game up so I can come and know that I'm going to see a decent game based upon that guy's energy, upon his training, I'm not going to come and pay you my money. And they are paying an awful lot of money. So if the fans don't go, these guys are going to go and they're going to be tested. And they're not going to complain about it because it's proper. It's right. They should take care of it.
My guest is Roosevelt Greer, who's just written an autobiography titled Rosie. Your coach wanted you to weigh in at 280, and he would...
84.
Oh, I'm sorry. And he would figure out these penalties as incentive for you, like finding you, I think, $100 per pound that you were over. What was so magical about the number 284 for you?
Well, what happened is that they determined that a ball player weighing a certain weight was more agile. And once you get too much weight, he loses agility. And also he's susceptible to getting hurt. And so they determined that I should weigh in at 284. Now, when I was younger, I could probably, like for instance, a refrigerator. At his age now, he can get away with carrying that kind of weight. But when he get older, it's going to bring him down. You're not going to be able to play as long because of the fact that he's not going to be able to carry it. He won't be able to recover as fast with all that excess weight on him because it really pulls you down. It takes a lot of energy to carry all that weight. So when you get older, you should bring your weight down.
Andy Robustelli was quoted as saying that finding you wasn't really much of an incentive to lose weight, so that people played on your vanity and they'd call you fatty and things like that during those periods when you had to lose pounds. Yes. Was that true? Did they tease you?
Yeah, but you see, you didn't want to go on the fat table.
What's the fat table?
Well, where they sit and watch you eat. I mean, some of the coaches have someone watch you eat.
You're kidding.
They make you lose weight, see, so they put you on the fat table. All the overweight guys, they had to go to the old fat guys. They had to go on the fat table, and so you were hastily ready to get that weight off of you. You know, it was kind of fun, you know. But I always always felt that I could maintain my control, and I can see how I developed bad eating habits. I love soul food. You know, I go to this restaurant where they had smothered pork chop and rice and gravy and biscuits and syrup and all that. I find those places up in Harlem. I go to practice and I go find those places and have a great meal. And I'd be eating one great meal and I say, okay, I want another one. You know, that's how dumb I was. And so I got bad eating habits. But really, you know, one has to control his eating habits. You don't have to worry about that. But one has to control that. And now, in my age now, it's important that I gain control again.
The Giants traded you to the Rams pretty suddenly, and you were really surprised. Were you really angry at that, having really felt that they were your family, you'd been with them throughout your whole career?
Mm-hmm.
What did it feel like to be traded?
It's like, do you have mom and dad?
Mm-hmm.
How would you like to go home? Your mom and dad said, "Don't come back."
Yeah, right.
I mean, we got another daughter that we're gonna adopt, or somebody else can come in and take your place, and we don't need you no more. I mean, you'd feel so hurt.
When you were with the Giants, they had developed into a winning team.
Oh yeah, in 7 years, I played in 5 World Championship games, and we had a great love for one another. We had this Expedia Corps. We would help one another. We encouraged one another, and when things went wrong on our team, we called a meeting and sat down, let's sell the problem. And so it was like a tremendous blow to me. It was a pride and ego and hurt that after all I had done to try to make us have a great team, you know, that went out of my way to talk to ball players who weren't complaining because they weren't getting a chance to play. I said, well, don't complain, just be better when you get your chance. You're going to get your chance, you know. And I did all those kind of things, and then I thought that they really didn't appreciate the love that I had for the team and the thing that I did to try to make us a better club, talk to the ball players, and try to get the guys to do the right things, you know. So when they traded me away, it was like I was very hurt, and they traded me all the way out to Los Angeles, which meant I didn't get a chance to play against them. And I never got to play against those guys until 4 years later.
Well, when you joined the Rams, they were a losing team. What was the difference in psychology between the psychology of a winning team and a losing team?
The difference was that the Rams were the black ball players on one side, the white ball players on the other side, and the kicker was in the middle. And they were all talking about their cliques, and they were all talking about their little groups and their individual statistics. And they didn't know what it took to win. And so when the black ball players said, join us, the white ball players said, join us, the other guys said, join us. And I said, guys, I got to tell you something. I didn't come out to join a clique. I came out to hold the line, and that's what I'm going to do. And that's, you know, the fearsome foursome was formed, you know, Marilyn Olsen, Deacon Jones, and Lamar, and Lund and I, we all began to stand together. And we began to be the team leaders. We began to set standards, and the guys began to come. And those guys who didn't want to be a part of began to be traded away. We started to develop the kind of esprit de corps that we had with the New York Giants. We began to talk about love. We began to talk about teamwork. We began to talk about the thing that would make us a better team.
In addition to your work with sports, you started becoming a little more active in the civil rights movement. Then you joined Robert Kennedy's campaign and worked very closely with him, kind of like an unofficial bodyguard. Do you think that's an accurate description of some of the work you were doing with him?
I think that's perhaps the most accurate description. I read a lot of time where people say I was bodyguard. But we didn't have bodyguards. It was just a group of Bobby's friends. You know, this was the period of time when they was calling the policemen all those names and stuff like that. And so they didn't want to have the police around, and they didn't have the Secret Service was not guarding the presidential candidates then. So it was up to the individual that was with them, the candidates at that particular time, to take them through the various crowds and to maintain control. So me being an athlete and a lot of big guys that was with Bobby a lot of times, we made it our decision to take care of him. And so that's what we did. We got him through the crowds. We held him up on the cars and stuff like that. So, yeah, I was an unofficial bodyguard, as all his friends were.
What would you do when you were guiding him through a crowd? How do you do that?
Well, the whole point was not let anyone put their hands on him, not let anyone hold him. So when a person put his hand on him, all you do is just take your hand between him. Like I would walk behind Bobby and someone walking in front of him backwards. And so when someone put their hand on, all you do is just take your hand, just flick their hand off either side of him. You could flick a person off either side of him just by hitting their hand quickly before they could stop him. And he was always wanting to shake hands. And so when he shook someone's hand, then you couldn't do it. You have to wait. And if he kept shaking hands, he usually would get pulled over. And so what you try to do is not let him take hands, let him touch the hands, let him do something else as opposed to let him shake hands with everyone. There were times when you couldn't stop him from shaking hands because he wanted to do that. What he wanted to do, you allowed him to do. And then I remember one time that we were in San Diego, and I had my hand around his waist and was standing up on the back of a car, a convertible. And he said, Bobby said, Rosie, you're holding me too tight. I said, but Bobby, if I don't hold you tight, they're going to pull you over. He said, don't hold me so tight. So I didn't hold him so tight, and they pulled him over. And you should have seen Ethel and I trying to pull him back up again. I mean, it was almost impossible. We eventually got him back up again. He never told me again not to hold him so tight.
You had to, I guess maybe you already knew this, but you had to probably learn how to use your body and use your facial expression to keep people in line, you know, to really be imposing so that they'd be afraid of you, you know, or intimidated by you, so that they wouldn't pull anything.
Well, you know, I'm a big guy.
Yes,
you is just my size alone. I'm towering over a lot of the people that in the crowds, and that you could see me standing up over most people, and so I wouldn't have to really be angry. It's just that I found out that to handle a situation immediately, as opposed to allowing it to continue to drag on. I remember once that I was in New York, and I came down the elevator, and I got off the elevator. There were these two guys fighting on the floor. and one guy was trying to mug another guy, and all these people were standing around, and no one, and I just died right, and I stopped it. And I learned to take action immediately before things got out of hand. And so anytime there was a problem, I'd get right in there and stop it right away. I didn't care. I just get in and stop it, did my part. And there was one time we was going through Watts, and some kid had straddled the hood of the car. And they was trying to say, get off that car. And this kid turned around, he cussed everybody out, and that was the car that Bobby was in. And I was struck back in a crowd somewhere doing something else. And I heard my name, Rosie, Rosie. So I came running up there, and there was this guy on his car. I says, hey, man, get off of that car. What are you stopping us for? He looked around. He said, Rosie. And he jumped off the car and wrapped his legs around me. And he was kissing me on the cheek, you know. And I told him, go on, you know. And Bobby told him, no. He said, wait. And so I put the guy down, and I got back in the car, and you know, it made me feel good that they didn't drive away and leave me in the crowd, you know. But, you know, there are a lot of times that, you know, you had to get out there and do things, you know, that to take advantage and to make sure that things was moving right.
Roosevelt Greer is my guest. One of the things that you did when you were with Kennedy was to basically pin down Sirhan Sirhan, his assassin. Can you recall that for us?
Yeah, you know, when we went... up on the stage, we were supposed to go another way, actually. Bobby was not supposed to go back the way he went that night. We had marked off another way because we were going to go from there. There was a nightclub up in Hollywood that we was going to go to after the campaign. Everybody was going to go there and wind down and enjoy themselves. We had won it. And so then we were, you know, going to go do that. So we had it all marked off so we can go right through the crowd. But a man named Bill Barry, and obviously, he and Bobby had changed signals on all of us, and we didn't know it. Rafe was trapped over on the left-hand side, so he said, we're going to go to the left. And so I was saying, no, everyone's on the right-hand side. So when Bobby came back and he and Ethel went forward, I said, Bobby, when you come back, come to me. But when he was coming back to me, Bill and I was talking about going left to right, and Bobby took off and go to the left, which he had already planned, obviously. So I jumped off the back to go catch up to Bobby, but I had to help Ethel that night. I was assigned to her. So I took her down off the stage.
And she was pregnant, right?
Yes, 6 months pregnant. And so Bill Barry and I helped her down. And so that meant that Bobby took off with a man named Paul Schrake, and everyone was out of position. So we all started rushing forward to try to catch up. And Bobby turned the corner, and that's when his shots rang out. And so I pushed Ethel down, and I ran forward. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I pushed her down. She fell down because when there was a loud shot anywhere near her, she'd fall over back. I mean, she'd just fall anyway. I mean, so after that, I ran forward, and then I turned around, and I hit the corner. Then I shot around fast, and to come into whatever was there, I was moving, you see. And I saw Sirhan with the gun, so I went. And to stop him, and there was people grappling around, but he wasn't in control. So I went and I grabbed him by his leg, took the gun hand, and put him up on his table. And George Plimpton, that was all these guys, Rafer Johnson and Bill Barry, everyone was grappling, trying. But I had control. And then George Plimpton had the gun pointed at his face, so I took my hand, put the trigger over my thumb so that at least it couldn't go off, and because I was trying to get the gun with George Pemberton's hand there and my hand, and I just had the gun covered so he couldn't fire it again, and then I just wrenched the gun out, and I locked his arms and his legs so he couldn't do anything. Then I had to fight off the people because they began to try to kill Sirhan, and it was an incredible night. And then I, you know, you're trying to look around, you're trying to yell for people to help. Bobby, who was down, and the other man who was down, and I didn't know all the other people were shot also. And I began to cry, and it just, you know, just an incredible, incredible situation.
So you think people were trying to kill Sirhan when they realized what he'd done?
Sure. Oh, yeah, they were either trying to kill him or hurt him really bad.
How long did it take till police or Secret Service came and took him?
There was no Secret Service. It was only the police that was coming, and probably the detective. All I know is that I have no idea how long it was. All I know is I held on to him until they came. And then they came, they took Bobby away and they took him away. And I had nothing. I was there. All my dreams were shattered. And I didn't know how badly he was hurt. People were trying to tell me that he wasn't hurt that bad. He was shot in the side. But I saw blood by his ear it felt awful. And he reminded me of a man that I saw shot a long time ago when I was a kid. So I felt an awful thing. And I walked around the gun for a while with the gun in my pocket. I sit down, I cried. And later on, Rayford Johnson came and asked me, did I have the gun? I said, yeah. And he asked me, would I give it to him? And so I said, sure, I gave him the gun. But it was just really, it was an awful time for all of us, all over the world and all over this country. People, even though some of the people maybe might not have liked Bobby, but that man had a right to live.
Would you put yourself in that position again? Of being responsible for?
I think there is a, there was a love, there was a warmth. You see, it wasn't all for Bobby. It was me getting involved in my country. It was me saying what I believe is right. It was me saying that this is the man who I trust. This was me representing to the nation or to the people that here was a man that I felt that they could trust in. So sure, I would get involved again, and I would get involved. I'm involved.
What's your political involvement now?
I'm very supportive of President Reagan.
That will strike people as being a very big political jump from Kennedy to Reagan.
Yeah, it was a big jump, but it was something that happened to me. Of course, you know, I'm a born again Christian, and I'm also an ordained minister. But I wasn't when I changed. Yes, I was. I felt that the Democratic Party left what I thought what they was representative of. It was the prayer initiative in Washington, D.C. that I went down to support with President Reagan and with myself, Tom Landry, Joe Gibbs, Mark Mosley, Lenny Moore, and DeMond Wilson, a man named Carl Johnson. We all went down there to be supportive of the initiative. It was voluntary prayer. What we're saying that allow the kids to pray in school if they want to, not mandatory prayer, but voluntary, because they had taken it out by legality. They said that it was not allowed, and because this lady didn't want her son to be around people that was praying. She was an atheist. But why should we deny our children that right to pray because someone don't want their children to be around kids if they're praying? He didn't have to, you know. But why deny us of our rights? And so I thought that that was a legitimate thing to do, to say voluntary prayer. And the friends that I had made over all the years that I supported as Democrats was telling me that it was a political issue. Well, I, being an ordained minister, know that is not true. And then there was some other issue, the issue of abortion. And that was among a number of things that I felt that we had irreconcilable difference, because I felt that a Democratic Party was now in control of people who were so out there that there was no way that if I stayed that I would be able to make an impact to impress them enough that they would change. So I decided that for the first time in my life, I would abandon that ship and go someplace else. And that's what I made my mind up, that I would be supportive of the president. President Reagan called me on the phone, and we talked about him as a political man, about what his feelings were. And as I got to know him, I felt very comfortable that that I could support him, realizing that the thing that he was advocating was very much different than I've always been part of, you know, about the federal government getting involved in individuals. But I began to see another analogy here, that the government were having poverty programs, and that meant that you kept the people in poverty. So I felt that the real freedom would come when mankind, all people, whether black or white, learn how to use their God-given talents to sustain themselves, that every man had an ability to succeed or fail based upon his own desires, upon his own effort and energy. Granted that racism had to be stopped in some capacity, but it was not up to the government to send my son to school or to do anything other than to make sure I had the same opportunities as everyone else.
President Reagan has not had a lot of support from American blacks. Have you tried to help him with that?
Well,
is that part of what the work he wants you to do?
Well, the analogy is that he has not had a lot of support. There are a great number of blacks that support President Reagan. because two things happened. He brought to the awareness of the need of black people to become self-sustaining, not to depend upon the government, not to depend upon someone to change maybe every 4 years, and this guy say, I'm going to do this. And what really woken me to the fact, when I began to look at all the promises that had been made to blacks by both parties, and none of those things had been realized, the black man was still in the ghetto. He was still waiting for someone to bail him out. He was still waiting for the prince to come and bail him out, and it wasn't coming. And it had to be left up to the individual person himself to take a stronghold on its own talents, upon its own skill, by taking advantage of the education system, by taking advantage of the opportunity to learn skills and trade, learning how to read, learning how to think highly of yourself, learning how to believe that I'm precious, I'm valuable, I'm unique, there's no one else in the world and better than I am, and I can make it, I can do it myself. And that, to me, is what need to happen. Now, what is this all, what am I saying? Is that I realize that I am a child of God. I realize that I can achieve success if I'm willing to pay the price.
And now you have a ministry working with inner city teenagers?
Yes, youngsters. I just believe that I want young people to begin to think about owning their own businesses. Yeah, I was very impressed with the Jews. What they showed me was that if their kids learned skills and trades and professions, that they would be successful. The Jews are no longer where the blacks are. And it's the same thing with the Japanese. I've seen the Japanese come out of war and become the most aggressive and the most energetic workers. And that's the same thing that need to happen to the black people. As any person who's down, they need to become enthusiastic about their opportunity. When I look at the world today, I see a tremendous opportunity for all kinds of things, business and all that.
Well, Roosevelt Greer, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today about your life. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate you, and I appreciate all the questions and the opportunity just to spend this period of time with you. Thank you so very much for promoting my book.
Well, thanks for being here. And my guest has been Roosevelt Greer, who played with the New York Giants and the Los Angeles Rams in the NFL in the 50s and 60s. And since then, he's acted on TV and in movies. He's worked for various political candidates and now has a ministry in California. He's written an autobiography. It's titled Rosie. And thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
It's 4 minutes to five. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you about the shows later this week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
We have a major problem. The Tacony-Palmyra Bridge is stuck in the up position. It's closed. It has been shut down for quite a while. Traffic is being detoured away from the area, and it is jammed. Simply avoid it if you can. The Betsy Ross Bridge is their main alternative, and that is also extremely slow this afternoon. Traveling the Schuylkill east or westbound between Gladwin and City, there's a 15-minute delay. 95 northbound, minor slowing near the Ben Franklin Bridge. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic report was funded by Temporary Furs. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Michael Musto, who writes a nightlife column in the Village Voice, which chronicles the downtown scene in New York City in the downtown clubs. He also has written his impressions of this world in his new book, Downtown. Wednesday afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Bill Earhart, a writer who was a Marine in Vietnam during the war. And he writes of his experiences of the Vietnam War in a new book called Marking Time. This is a sequel to his first book. His first book was about fighting in the war. His new book is about returning home. Also later this week on Fresh Air, Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, we're going to feature an interview with Philadelphia Daily News sports writer Ray Didinger. We're going to be talking about covering sports and about a special series he wrote on professional wrestling. And we're going to rebroadcast a concert that we had earlier this year of jazz and pop tunes with rhythm guitarist Marty Gross and saxophonist and clarinetist Dick Meldonian. This Sunday at 6 on The Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be filmmaker John Waters, whose movies include Pink Flamingos, Female Trouble, and Polyester. So I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Ron Barron and Audrey Voblaitis, engineers for today's show. Assistance today from Marty Moss Cohen. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. And I want to thank Danny Miller for hosting the show these last 2 weeks while I was on vacation. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening and hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts invites you to visit this summer. Located at the corner of Broad and Cherry Streets in Philadelphia, the Academy is the home of an exciting collection spanning three centuries of American art. The collection features outstanding works by Charles Wilson Peale, Thomas Aikens, Winslow Homer, and Mary Cassatt. This summer, the Academy is the only East Coast stop for the critically acclaimed retrospective Franz Kline, The Vital Gesture. Robert Hughes, Time Magazine's art critic, characterized this show as distinguished.